This is Culturetopia, a look back at the week's very best arts reporting from National Public Radio. I'm Netta Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Linda Holmes, writer and editor for NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
Every week, we bring you the very best cultural coverage, from books and movies to music, television, and everything in between. And you can find links to all the stories we feature each week at npr.org/Culturetopia. This week,
we commemorate the 20th anniversary of Spike Lee's film Do the Right Thing. We look at Hasbro, the toy company behind two of this summer's biggest action flicks. And the guys from Maroon 5 tell you why you must hear Purple Rain.
I don't need them to tell me that.
I bet you don't.
But first, Linda posted something on her blog, Monkey See, this week when pop icon Michael Jackson died. Will you tell us a little bit about the essay that you wrote?
Well, the thing about writing about Michael Jackson is it's very complicated because, of course, there's the onstage stuff and then there's this incredibly complicated offstage life that he lived. It became very difficult at the time of his death, I think, for a lot of writers to try to wrap your arms around the whole Michael Jackson phenomenon. So my response, as soon as I sort of heard this news, what I thought back to was this performance of Billie Jean that he did at the Motown 25 TV special, which aired in May of 1983, about 6 months after Thriller had come out. It was where he debuted the moonwalk. And I was in middle school at that time. And I have a memory that is so sharp of what a big deal that was in terms of going to school after that and having everybody talk about, did you see him do that? And nobody really being able to figure out exactly how he did it. And of course, this was before YouTube. So you really only had your recollection of it and your understanding of it. And they would show the clip, you know, on Entertainment Tonight or whatever, but you didn't have instant access to it the same way. So it sort of became this legend a little bit, even though it was very current.
There's this great moment in your essay when you're describing the scream that the audience gives when he bursts into the moonwalk for the very first time, and you say it's not a scream of wonder, it's a scream of shock.
When you see him do it the first time, if you've never seen this guy, and of course, at that time, cable was much newer, MTV had much less market penetration, lots and lots of people, even if they had been hearing this record on the radio, had never seen this. And so the first time you see this kind of dancing and that move in particular, it's just shocking. It's really a new way of looking at a dancing pop star. To me, the easiest way to sort of think about that event was to sort of go down to this very small moment and just watch this video of this remarkable dance performance that became so important in his development as a pop icon.
You know, when I think about the cultural milestones that kind of marked the 1980s, you know, that was one. And another one was the moment when the character that Spike Lee plays in Do the Right Thing throws the garbage can through the window of Sal's Pizzeria.
Absolutely. For those who haven't seen it yet, Do the Right Thing is a tale of racial and ethnic tensions reaching the boiling point in a multi-ethnic neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York, on the hottest day of the year. Tell Me More's Michelle Martin spoke with Natalie Hopkinson, associate editor for The Root, and in this clip they address a particular scene in which the character Buggin' Out is begging the pizza owner to put a picture of someone black on his wall.
Hey, Sal, how come you got no brothers on the wall here?
You want brothers on the wall? Get your own place. You can do what you want to do. You can put your brothers and uncles and nieces and nephews, your stepfather, stepmother, whoever you want, you see? But this is my pizzeria. American Italians on the wall only.
Yeah, that might be fine, Sal, but you own this. Rarely do I see any American Italians eating in here. All I see is black folks. So since we spend much money here, we do have some say.
What did that say to you?
Yeah, again,
and what does it say to you then, and what does it say to you now?
Again, then, you know, like there were a lot of battles over representation and black people getting their recognition in society in general. Now, and you know, this is all, and my essay was definitely looking at through 2009 eyes. Today, it does feel, you know, like he's begging this white man to put, you know, a black picture on the wall when I'm just like, why don't you get your own restaurant? Why don't you put your own pictures up on the wall? You know, what a meaningless gesture to ask someone for. You know, why don't you ask for jobs? Why don't you ask for better schools? Why don't you ask for something that's a little bit more concrete than having a black picture on the wall?
And but I think what may be the most provocative part of the essay, you say it's time to invite Sal, who was the pizza owner whose shop was trashed in this as a pivotal scene in the film. It's time to invite him back into the neighborhood. Tell me about
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. I mean, I talk a little bit in the essay about, you know, my experience in Bloomingdale and in Washington, D.C., and we are begging a pizzeria to come in. We would love Sal to come in. And you know, we have to drive all the way across town to get a decent slice. And we would be very, very happy to have Sal back in the neighborhood. And there actually are remnants of an Italian-American presence in our neighborhood today. And, you know, they've held on over the decades, and they're not very visible. And it really is time to welcome them back into the neighborhood and bring them back into the fold. And, you know, for the communities to realize the multicultural, multi-ethnic place that they were always meant to be, or they could be.
I live in Bloomingdale.
Do you?
We're dying for a pizzeria.
It's true. And you can hear the full interview about Do the Right Thing on our website, npr.org/culturetopia.
Now, I don't know if you saw the story in the New York Times last week about this young economics student at Princeton. She did the study about women playwrights. It was an incredible story. And she came on Talk of the Nation to discuss the findings of her study, which was basically about, it really sort of turned on its head a lot of people's expectations about female playwrights and the theaters. And apparently when she gave the presentation to this audience, mostly of theater people, they gasped in shock. It was just like The Moonwalk, except bad.
Yeah.
So let's hear a little bit of that talk from Talk of the Nation.
Female playwrights are deemed to produce works of lower overall quality that have lower economic prospects, even holding constant precisely the script and the type of work. In one study, I sent out four scripts to artistic directors and producers around the country, and I varied only the gender of the pen name. So, for example, Lynn Nottage, Pulitzer Prize winner, generously donated a script excerpt of 10 pages for the purpose of this study. I made 250 copies. On 125 copies, I put the name Mary Walker, and on 125 copies, I put the name Michael Walker. I then sent out the scripts to artistic directors and literary managers around the country, 250 of them in all, and asked them to rate the scripts along 18 different metrics. I asked them to rate it along measures of overall quality, such as likability of characters, to what extent the piece is an example of artistic exceptionalism, and the likelihood of winning a prize, as well as economic prospects, audience appeal, and so on. And I found that for the exact same script, when that script wore a female pen name, it was less well received by the theater community than when that script wore a male pen name.
Yet we read in the New York Times account of your presentation, the male artistic directors who received this, there was no difference between their evaluation on the quality basis between the male and female name. However, the female artistic directors, they preferred the male.
The results of that really are sort of appalling to me, I have to admit. But what I really admire about her discussion of it is that it's such a straightforwardly designed study to, you know, obtain the assistance of a playwright to give you a sample and then just go ahead and do it and just vary only that one factor so you feel like you're getting this very easy to interpret result. I like her study design in that regard, but it's a very depressing result.
I totally think it's worth going and looking at if it's something that you're interested in. But speaking of simple things and primitive things.
Absolutely. Archaeologists say they've unearthed the world's oldest musical instruments. They are flutes made of vulture bone and mammoth tusks. They were found in caves in southwestern Germany, and they date back to the time when modern human beings who looked like us were first venturing into Europe. NPR's Richard Harris has our story.
Scientists have little doubt that music is so basic to human nature that it goes back to our earliest days as a species. It's hard not to make music when you think about it.
Clap your hands, tap your foot, dance, whistle, sing. There are any, you know, endless kinds of music you can make just with your body.
But Nicholas Kennard is an archaeologist, so he's looking for hard evidence of early music. He and his colleagues now report in Nature a spectacular discovery, four flutes buried in Ice Age garbage heaps in the caves of Germany. They date back 35,000 to 40,000 years, making them the oldest undisputed musical instruments. One of the flutes is made of a vulture wing bone, about 9 inches long. A replica sounds like this.
A
other flutes were made out of mammoth tusks. The early musicians clearly had leisure time, not only to play, but to make instruments.
Yeah, really quite a surprise that flutes would be made out of massive mammoth ivory, which is a material that's very hard to work, and not just bird bones, which are hollow and sort of ideal for making flutes.
Kennard at the University of Tübingen in Germany suspects the ivory flutes were favored because they produced a deeper, richer tone. He says archaeologists have found similar ivory flutes in more recent cave deposits and have figured out what it took to make them. First, a tube of ivory needs to be whittled from the larger tusk and then split in half.
Then you have to hollow it out, get the exact form, smooth out the inside and the outside, cut the ends to length and perfectly cut the finger holes. And even if you can do all that, then you've got the problem of how to get the two halves together.
The ancient craftsmen cut delicate notches in order to get the halves to fit just so.
Then you have to seal it with birch pitch or some kind of sealant or glue, and then you can play it.
Oh, for the simple days of vulture flutes. The first Transformer movie made nearly $750 million at the box office. It also helped Hasbro sell tons of Transformer toys. In fact, Hasbro toys are coming to life in not one but two movies. G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra is out in August. As Nate DeMeo reports, the Rhode Island toy maker is one of Hollywood's biggest moneymakers this summer.
The first Transformers movie was a triumph. If you were a 12-year-old boy, it had everything. It had explosions, it had the exposed midriff of Megan Fox, it had cars and giant robots, and cars that turn into giant robots.
Whoa! Whoa! What was that?
And if you were the 40-something head of the world's second-largest toy company, the movie was a triumph on other levels.
For so many years, Hasbro brands, they were really only thought about in a few day parts of a consumer's life.
Phrases like day parts of a consumer's life roll off Brian Goldner's tongue. He's Hasbro's CEO. When he took over the company in 2000, many of its most famous toy lines, like Transformers, My Little Pony, and G.I. Joe, had fallen fallow. He had watched Spider-Man and X-Men jump lucratively from comics to movies, and then onto video games and mobile phone content and toothbrushes.
Transformers and G.I. Joe needed to become motion pictures.
This is General Hawk. Mission is a go.
G.I. Joe will make the leap from 4-inch action figure to the big screen in August, and try to duplicate the success of the Transformers franchise by offering up its own explosions and action. But for all of their state-of-the-art special effects, these new movies are simply a flashy way for Hasbro to get back to basics.
Yo, Joe!
He'll fight for freedom wherever there's trouble. G.I. Joe is there!
In the mid-80s, Hasbro figured out that you could sell more toys if you gave kids more than just a commercial in the middle of a cartoon show. It made whole cartoons that were giant commercials. Parents groups and consumer watchdogs said these shows were terrible. And at least on an aesthetic level, they were right.
It's G.I. Joe against Cobra the enemy, fighting to save the day.
Even Hasbro's CEO concedes that those cartoons were lame. But lame was good enough 25 years ago.
Consumers' expectations were very different than they are today.
So Goldner and Hasbro have lined up partnerships with the biggest names in movies. Michael Bay, Steven Spielberg, DreamWorks, Paramount, Universal. Names that tell consumers that this may be a big ad, but at least it should be an entertaining one. And it's clearly worked so far.
It's pretty much as close to printing money as you're going to get in the toy business.
Cliff Anicelli runs the toy industry journal Playthings Magazine. He points out that the film studios are taking on the financial risk by actually producing the movies. Hasbro misses out on the box office take, but gets to sell all those toys. It announced a string of movies based on some of the most famous names in Hasbro's toy chest, the board games Monopoly, Ouija, Candyland, and Battleship. Though Anicelli does say that news was met with some raised eyebrows.
How are you going to make a movie out of the board game Battleship that involves anything more than someone screaming, "You sank my battleship"?
Hasbro's CEO is undeterred. Brian Goldner says people love those brands. They're eager to form a deeper relationship with the board game.
They are willingly interested in and accepting of Monopoly in any format you might want to present it.
Multiple Oscar nominee Ridley Scott is attached to direct that Monopoly movie. Perhaps there'll be a Quentin Tarantino My Little Pony down the road. For NPR News, I'm Nate DeMeo.
I will also say that on the blog this week, we had a post about possible additional movies based on famous childhood toys, where the commenters helped me come up with some perspective, incredibly tense action movies based on, for example, the Easy Bake Oven, and some possible taglines for them. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, the possible world of speculative toy movies of the future, you can find that on the blog. From the giant play explosions of the Transformers and G.I. Joe movies to the very real explosions contained in a new movie, The Hurt Locker. Several years ago, the journalist Mark Boll was embedded with a bomb squad while covering American troops in Iraq. That experience led him to write the screenplay for the new war movie, The Hurt Locker. It follows a bomb squad on its daily rounds. Critic Bob Mondello says it follows a little closer than some moviegoers might find comfortable.
There's nothing quite like blowing up a major star in the first 5 minutes of a movie to put an audience on notice. I won't tell you who. Suffice it to say, he seems to be being cautious, first using a radio-controlled robot to explode a bomb half a block away, and then, when the robot gets stuck, donning a bulky protective suit and helmet that make him look like a deep-sea diver.
It's nice and hot in here.
All as it happens for naught.
Okay, I'm laying on the charge. Nice and sweet. I'm coming back.
His men warily watch the locals, looking for triggering devices. And when he's still much too close, they spot one.
25.
25 meters, roger that.
Butcher shop, 2 o'clock, dude has a phone.
Why is Eldridge running? Come on, guys, talk to me.
Drop the phone!
Hey, bro!
I can't get a shot!
This is a guy who's careful. So when the guy replacing him appears more cavalier, it really spooks the squad. And after this opening should spook audiences as well. Staff Sergeant Will James, played by Jeremy Renner, may be a careful, even a talented technician, but he comes off as a showboating cowboy, as likely as not to strip off his protective gear when he approaches a bomb.
What's he doing?
I don't know.
What are you doing?
There's enough bang in there to send us all to Jesus. I'm gonna die. I'm gonna die comfortable.
The adrenaline rush of war has been largely missing from Hollywood's Iraq, but it's certainly front and center in The Hurt Locker, the first war movie in a while that feels as if it could have starred John Wayne. Director Kathryn Bigelow ratchets up tension and jangles nerves with scene after scene that could go either way, as when the squad tries to free a terrified Iraqi who's been chained into a bomb harness.
There's too many locks. There's too many. I can't do it.
I do.
I can't get it off. I'm sorry, okay? You understand? I'm sorry.
Let off me.
You hear me? I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Get down now.
If the film were just a series of explosions artfully shot, Bigelow might lay claim to making a ferociously effective war flick, but she and screenwriter Mark Boll are aiming a little higher. They want to get inside the heads of the men in the squad, a trickier proposition. When the film gets misty about subsidiary characters, it also gets a bit lost, but more often it's psychologically astute, especially when demonstrating how friction between the new guy and the squad smooths a bit when they discover he's got a sentimental side, a keepsake box filled with bomb parts.
This one, y'all, is from our first call together. This box is full of stuff that almost killed me.
What about this one? Where's this one from, Will?
It's my wedding ring. Like I said, stuff that almost killed me.
There are things the Hurt Locker does not do. The Iraqis mostly are just scowling faces, and the reasons for the American presence are left to other movies. The focus here is on a single bomb squad, and if the quote that first lights up the screen, "War is a drug," has been amply illustrated by the end of The Hurt Locker, what Bigelow makes even more explosively clear is that for these men, war is also centrally a job they have to be really good at, or they won't do it for long. I'm Bob Mondello.
You know, I saw a preview of the movie for a piece that I'm working on and talked to Kathryn Bigelow, and one thing she said was that I actually found the performance of the Iraqi actors to be incredible. Mm-hmm. There aren't that many of them, but there are a few of them, and they were all professional actors who were refugees in Jordan where the movie was shot. And she told me that the one you hear in that really terrifying clip,
right,
the one where, you know, he's got the bomb chained to him, he since that movie has relocated to the United States and has a green card and is working here as an actor.
Interesting. Very interesting.
It's nice. Finally, what music inspires you and keeps you listening again and again. That's what a new series called You Must Hear This hopes to find out. In this segment, Maroon 5 members Jesse Carmichael and Adam Levine share a love of the 1984 movie and album Purple Rain. The music comes from Prince and the Revolution, and we'll hear first from Jesse Carmichael on the occasion of its 25th anniversary.
It's interesting when you discover somebody that was around before your time. I really got into the album Purple Rain after I saw the movie, and it was one of those times when I thought, how could nobody have told me about this earlier? The album starts with Let's Go Crazy, and when you hear the sound of the organ and his gospel sermon begins, you really get sucked into a whole new world.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life.
I think he sums up everything I think about life at the end of that monologue when he says, in this life, you're on your own. And if the elevator tries to bring you down, go crazy.
The album Purple Rain is as enigmatic as Prince himself. It's so difficult to break down or articulate why it's so special. It's Hendrix, it's James Brown, it's outer space, it's church, it's sex, it's heavy metal. But at the end of the day, it's just Prince at his absolute best.
The reason Prince is an inspiration to me is that he's obviously writing from the heart. And somehow he's able to take these personal feelings, turn them into poetry, and then present them in a way that's accessible and weird at the same time.
What makes the record so special is that no one had ever really heard anything quite like it. It's such a fearless record. The music is just completely limitless and unselfconscious about what it is. And that's why I truly, genuinely love it.
Basically, I think of Prince like a god in another realm. It's easier for me to think of him as a character in a movie than a real person. I mean, of all the people who might be aliens or angels or something like that, if we found out that he was not of this earth, I wouldn't be that surprised.
What really puts it over the top is how the music is performed in the film. It's as exciting and eclectic as the music itself. People never would have fully understood what it was unless you could see it unfold in front of you visually. It's truly brilliant, and you must hear it.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I'm Netta Ulibi.
Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.